Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and legal procedures and puts them into everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today we're going to look at a new bill introduced in the Ohio General Assembly that attempts to negate a state constitutional amendment protecting abortion rights. This bill, if passed, could be a model for other states to eliminate abortion, possibly IVF, and some forms of birth control like IUDs. Well, Judge Gale, let's start with me giving just a tad of background for our people outside of Ohio and bring them up to date. The Ohio voters back in 2023 passed an amendment to the Ohio Constitution called the Ohio Reproductive Freedom Amendment. Passed it by 57% of the vote, establishing the right to abortion in the Ohio Constitution. Now, you know, just a couple years later, a gerrymandered MAGA Republican biased House of Representatives in Ohio, two guys introduced House Bill 370, which basically is trying to set up a conflict between the U.S. Constitution and the Ohio Constitution. What they're trying to say is that by statute, they can decide that a person becomes a person at the time the sperm fertilizes the egg, period. And if that's the case, anything that happens to that person after that event can be criminally charged. So abortion could become murder. That's oversimplistic, but that's what we're talking about. This just blows my mind, Judge.
Absolutely shocking on so many levels. First of all, I don't put it past anyone, especially in this day and age, to find some creative legal arguments to attempt to achieve a particular end goal. So, now using the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause, which appears to be the prevailing law that's being used here, is a very interesting approach. And I think what's more is under other, I won't even say normal because I don't know what normal is anymore, but under other circumstances, I think this would have been kind of summarily dismissed. But I also think at the same time, given the current environment and how the bench has been so politicized and how judges in particular are being, you know, leaned upon in many regards, bullied, threatened, or you know, reminded of these expectations of how they will conduct themselves on the bench, I think this creates the ideal environment for this type of response to, more than anything, to the will of the voters, right? Because what we've been telling people is, in a democracy, voters, the voice of the voters matter. And the voice of the voters count. And we've been telling them, you have to vote. That's how you make your voice heard. That's how things change. That's how things are done. And in Ohio, and quite frankly, I'll also say this, you might recall, Ohio wasn't the lone state to pass a constitutional amendment.
Other states, surprisingly, like Kansas and other
places.
And
I want to say maybe Nebraska as well.
Right.
But yes,
yeah,
there were states that you know, again, if we're talking about the political spectrum, they lean or they swing toward a more conservative bend. And so Ohio is much like that as well. And in fact, Ohio, you know, had not delivered its presidential electoral votes to a Democrat since Barack Obama. And so with that being the case, Ohio's clearly trending more red than blue. It's not even purple anymore. It's largely red. But even with regard to that, like you said, you had states like Nebraska, Kansas, et cetera, that trend the same way. And they too were, again, their people, their citizenry, fed a bill of goods and told, you need to vote, make your voice heard, participate, activate, you know, get out here. And they did just that so as to enshrine these rights in their state's constitution, which, by the way, and I'm going to put a pen note right here, none of this would have been necessary but for the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on abortion.
True.
This is the patchwork of precedent that you and I predicted would be the outcome if they did exactly what they did. Now we've created this. Now with this in mind, we had almost, 60% of the voting electorate in
57%.
Which is actually a pretty high threshold.
Oh, it's very high.
It's very high, especially considering how even then the state legislature tried to change the rules to make it a 60% threshold. And they were unsuccessful with regard to that, but you still have 57% of the voters who said this is something that we want enshrined in our state constitution. Since we now, as a state, every state has to decide for themselves. And allegedly, you know, even the president, the current president, supported the idea that states decide on their own. And how do states decide? Well, states decide not through their elected representatives, but they decided directly at the ballot box. They put it on the ballot, and the electorate, the citizenry, the constituents decided for themselves. They didn't need representatives coming in to kind of substitute their judgment for that of the people. The people did it themselves. And so you get this outcome of 60%. Or almost 60%, 57% of the electorate saying, hey, yes, we want this constitutional right enshrined in our state law, in our state constitution. And then in response to that, the idea is that you have state legislators that say, well, you know what, the people don't really know what's good for them. And so that's why they elected me, which, by the way, and I'm not diminishing anyone, the sponsors of this bill, the lead sponsors, one is a plumber and another one is a pastor. Neither of them are doctors, lawyers, nurses, right. medical practitioners, or anything.
And both are men.
And both are men. Both are men and are essentially saying the voters don't even know what's in their best interest. We know better than they do.
All right, let me break down what this sort of means legally, and then we can take the discussion from there. If a person becomes a person at the time of fertilization, then the argument is that person is, whether it's they call it a pre-born person. That pre-born person has every federal constitutional right that a living person would have. And under the 14th Amendment, they have rights to basically not be killed. You know, that's what it boils down to. The pre-person has a right not to be killed, is their idea.
This is just an amazing twist, and I think also an affront to even what the framers intended when the Constitution was written. Because consider the fact that the right, and although the right to not be killed is a right that those living certainly enjoy, imagine all of the other rights that are available to the person. And so are we now going to require child support payments at the time of fertilization? Will the law now require that, you know, again, with the efforts, the extreme efforts to not cut a hole in, but to literally light a match to and burn the social safety net? What other right are we suggesting that all of the other rights that would otherwise inure to a person pre or otherwise will what not now be available?
Well, I've got some hypotheticals that we're going to get to here in a couple of minutes.
You must be reading my mind.
That we're going to talk about this, but basically, what the statute says or the bill says is that a person pre-born is protected by the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution from being killed, and that the U.S. Constitution trumps and supersedes the Ohio Constitution, thereby wiping out Ohio's freedom of reproductive freedom amendment that was just passed 2 years ago.
And sending a signal to every other state, follow our lead if we're
right.
successful.
Okay, so there was a quote that I came up from a guy by the name of Austin Beagle. He's associated with End Abortion Ohio. And he says that in an article in the Ohio Capital Journal, it as reported by WEWS in Cleveland, he says that this statute is intended, Judge Gale, to go against the voters' 2023 wishes. Now, I want to give you this quote exactly. His quote is, "It goes against the majority opinion of the people of Ohio, and that's something we are proud of, because there have been many times in our country's history where the people have asked for something evil. Slavery was once legal in our country." End quote. Now,
heart, swallow there.
Can you, I mean, there was a pregnant pause there. Can you believe that quote?
In this environment, yes, I can. Does it make it any less stunning and hypocritical? Does it make it any less atrocious? No. But yes, I believe it. I absolutely believe it.
Okay.
I absolutely believe it. It's unfortunate, but yes, I do.
So the wording of the statute, let's be clear here, does not have any exceptions for this pre-born person for rape or incest.
Correct.
So you're pregnant, that's it.
I think it is to save the life of the mother. And that's only after there's some showing that all other essentially heroic measures to save the life of the mother and the child have been made.
The undertaking of life-saving procedures on a pregnant woman when such procedures are accompanied by reasonable steps, if available, to save the life of her unborn child. Mm-hmm. A legal quagmire if there ever was one.
Indeed.
Right there. And spontaneous miscarriage. Those are the only two exceptions to the killing of a pre-born person, which is, let's get this straight, a fertilized egg. That's it.
Which is also, I think, why it imputes now or suggests the illegality of IVF.
Yeah. Talk about that.
There's no way to, I don't think there's a way to have the discussion without talking about the process of in vitro fertilization, which does involve the fertilization of an egg with sperm, and the implantation of that, which does not always take. Is not always successful. And in some instances where it is, you still have fertilized eggs that ultimately are destroyed for various reasons. But it seems that this legislation would outlaw or would criminalize even that. Even that. And that's just stunning. It also means that for families who desire to exist or to expand or to add to themselves and cannot do so naturally, that their options are extraordinarily limited. IVF certainly is not an option, maybe surrogacy. But again, so what happens if you have a surrogate and your surrogate, you know, somehow loses the baby through no fault of your own? Who do you make responsible? I mean, legally, the biological parents are responsible for that child as well as the expenses. But to what degree do we provide, you know, legal cover to the surrogate?
So in a quote to a news organization called Miami Valley Today, one of the sponsors, Representative Newman, claims that the language does not seek to end IVF, even though clearly it does.
Clearly it does. Well, I tell you what, test it and see, because if this passes, you're surely going to have many an instance where this is going to be the legal question to be resolved.
Yeah, he says that it highlights the need for better ethical standards for IVF. Now, that's bull hockey.
I was just going to say, the other word, but, you know, this is also
much of a family show. I mean, that's just bullshit. What it is.
I absolutely agree, because here's the thing is, if you want to discuss the ethics of IVF and how to approach that, then address that head on. But this is slip covering. Part of the intent, I think it still goes back to what I think is at the heart of all of this, which is politics, because you're going to have to sell the voters on something once this happens. Remember, these are the same folks that are going to be up for election as well. And again, we're talking about, you know, a community that elected a plumber and another community that elected a minister, and they can have deeply held beliefs. I'm not here to substitute my beliefs for theirs. What I am concerned about is them imposing their beliefs on me. And everybody could, you know, just do a Tim Walz and mind your own damn business, and I think life would be fine, because I believe that's what the Ohio voters intended when they enshrined the right in the Constitution, which was to say, hey, listen, to enshrine the right does not mean that everyone has to take advantage of it. It just protects the people who do want to take advantage of it. And it tells the other people, do whatever you want to do. I don't have an opinion one way or another. If your family planning is informed by your faith, which says that you do not practice, recognize, honor, respect, or in any way give an audience to abortion except under those very, very, very limited circumstances, then I am not here to fight your faith.
So be it. So be it.
I'm not here to even convert you to another faith.
So be it. Yeah, so, that's your choice.
So be it. That is your choice. That is your decision. Let me tell you something. I'm not looking for a seat at anybody's table when they are seeking to make what are some of the most private decisions in their life. And as you pointed out, Judge Tom, when we talk about not providing exceptions in cases of rape and incest, these are, as a former prosecutor, I will tell you, these are some of the most difficult, challenging, damaging cases you will ever, ever, ever deal with. And I realize that, listen, there are those who will argue, well, it's not the baby's fault. Well, it's not the mom's fault either. It is just the way that women are created and that they are designed to carry children through into birth. But when you have the traumatic experience of rape or incest, what you are also forcing upon somebody is not just your faith belief, which, look, everybody's got to deal with that on their own terms, but you are also telling them, be damned with your trauma. Who cares?
Yeah, your trauma is meaningless.
Trauma meaningless, I don't even care how you are impacted and whether or not you ultimately take this out on an innocent child. whether or not you act out because you've not had the access to services, because these things all do kind of go hand in hand.
And while by the way, we're cutting all your services. We're cutting Medicaid. We're cutting SNAP. We're cutting all of the services that might go to help you raise this child that we're making you have.
You are absolutely reading my mind. And it's so, and it not even just, in addition to helping you raise this child, you're right, lighting a match to the social safety net. We're not talking about merely cutting a hole in it where a couple people will fall through. How about just light a match and burn the whole thing up? So there is no social safety net. So there's no way for you to medically treat your child or yourself. There's no way for you to feed your child or yourself. There's no way for you to house your child or yourself. There's no way for you to provide child care for your child so that you can work, because we do expect you to find some boots with some straps and then pull yourself up by them while handling all of this that we've now said as a society. Now, yes, that's all your responsibility. I think this is one of the most irresponsible approaches to dealing with what is, I think, a deeply personal issue that should be left to the decision makers. And that I think it was Pastor Raphael Warnock who said it best. I want to say maybe it was a year or two ago, he was doing an interview, and he says, you know, he just thinks that a doctor's office should not include the doctor, the patient, and the lawmaker. That's just way too many people in the doctor's office. And I absolutely agree that you just got way too many people in there thinking that they know better than the people that are directly impacted by it. And it's offensive to suggest that the voters, that the majority of voters, now, again, if we can trust these voters to put these legislators in office, but the same voters can't be trusted to determine or decide their own fate, is the height of hypocrisy, whether you are a preacher, a plumber, a butcher, a dentist, or a domestic worker, or a ditch digger. I don't care. But if you're going to trust the people enough to vote you in, and then you then tell them that we don't, now that you voted me in, I don't trust you enough to make your own decisions. You are the embodiment of hypocrisy.
Okay. I agree. let's move on, because it is clear that, and actually the language of the bill says that if a woman has an abortion, she can be charged, if this bill became law, with homicide, even up to and including murder. Mm-hmm. The doctor could be charged with homicide, even up to and including murder. Anybody that advised, encouraged the woman to get the abortion could be charged with homicide, even up to and including murder.
How do you prove that? I mean, come on. If I'm having a conversation with you or you're having a conversation with me and you merely say, well, hey, you know, given what you've said and the fact that the baby is likely not going to be viable, and even if it is, it's going to have some very, very, it's going to be in pain all the time and it's going to have a very difficult life. Have you considered whether or not you want to go through with this? Merely having that conversation, are we going to suggest that you can meet the elements of any homicide charge?
Yeah, it's beyond my comprehension. I think it's just spitting into the wind. You know, that part of it is just too squishy.
You sound like Judge Zinus. I was reading an article, the federal Judge Zinus in Maryland said it's like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall.
Yeah.
So this sounds like nailing Jell-O to the wall.
Exactly. But also, there's one defense to the murder charge against the mother-to-be. And that is the common law defense of duress. In other words, if she was threatened to and forced to do this by someone, then that would be a defense against a murder charge. Pretty weak ass bone that they threw to the expectant mother, in my view.
And remember, for any defense that's raised, it is the duty of the defendant to prove the defense, not the duty of the prosecution. The prosecution could care less about what your defense is. The whole responsibility falls on the defendant. And also, for the benefit of our listeners, what we want you to understand is that, at least in Ohio, and as is the case in many jurisdictions, there are several permutations or several types of murder or homicide.
Yeah, I think in Ohio, there are seven different kinds of homicide charges, which would be one person killing another person or causing the death of another person.
Correct. And so what at least this legislation seems to suggest is that I don't know that they're necessarily suggesting that the death of the preborn is an automatic, you know, aggravated murder charge, right? But you know, you could also be looking at manslaughter charges, voluntary or involuntary. You could, you know, be looking at all types of
everything from murder. Negligent homicide up to aggravated murder, which is a pre-planned design to kill someone, which this could be.
Yes.
Yeah, under the language of the bill.
Yes, under the language that you could be facing aggravated murder, which is, you know, we're talking about the same kind of, you know, murder charge where, you know, you've had cases where folks have, you know, they lay in wait and they plan and they plot it out and they run the route in advance and they decide the date and they align all of the, you know, all the things that are necessary to not just commit the crime, but to attempt to cover it up afterwards. That's pretty shocking, again, and you're right, because in Ohio, you know, we still have the death penalty. And so I go back to this, you know, this idea of, you know, this seems to be amazingly hypocritical. I am thinking now, what happens when you have the victim of human trafficking whose pimp requires her for the exchange of money to sleep with multiple men? So she doesn't, you know, and this is, again, this is not voluntary. This is absolute force, fraud, or coercion, depending upon which manner they want to use. And what happens when the trafficked victim becomes pregnant by who knows who, right? You don't know who the father is. And ultimately, this preborn, you can't get child support from them, apparently. But now, if you are forcing the victim of human trafficking to now give birth to a child that they never desired, and but for their circumstance, likely would not have been pregnant anyways, are you not creating an environment almost tantamount to slavery where essentially that child could be born into a situation when they're just old enough, now they become the next trafficked victim?
Yeah. Precisely.
I don't think there's a lot of forward thinking here, because we're not talking about how, you know, there's this whole element that's an undercurrent to this, where we're essentially, you know, going to provide a pass and give an ability to this criminalized behavior to just make it worse. I mean, really? There's a whole lot of other ways to deal with this, and this ain't it.
Talking about forward thinking, I've come up with some hypotheticals I want to run by you. So part of these, you're going to have your judge hat on. Part of these, you're going to have your former prosecutor hat on. So
I hope your defense hat is on, because they're going to need it.
It is, but for our audience, when you go to law school and you go to any kind of credible law school, they teach you law through hypotheticals. They tell you what the law is, and then they give you all these hypothetical situations where you either have to apply the law or say how it applies or how it doesn't apply. So I'm bringing this back to law school days here, Judge Gale. Let's see what we can come up with, all right? I've got four of them. So hypothetical number one, are you ready?
I am.
All right. So it's unclear in the language of the statute whether the homicide provision would apply to a woman who was impregnated in Ohio, but traveled to another state to have a legal abortion. So if the person was impregnated in Ohio, but went, say, to Massachusetts and had a legal abortion, would the mother still be charged with murder in Ohio, even though the abortion was legal? What do you think?
I think in my view that there would be a really big problem with charging the mother with murder in Ohio, as the act did not take place in Ohio, except that, yeah, I don't even know how or if one could prove that she actually became pregnant in Ohio, if she, you know, perhaps had traveled somewhere else just prior to learning she was pregnant. But let's assume she did. Let's give you that she became pregnant in Ohio. I don't think she could be charged with murder given the language of the statute, but I do think she should be charged with stupidity for returning to Ohio, because they've made it really clear that it's inhospitable for her, so she should probably stay in Massachusetts.
Would the out-of-state doctor be charged in Ohio with murder, even though he's a resident of another state that permitted abortion? Since the person was a pre-born person in Ohio that was killed by a doctor in another state.
See, I don't think Ohio is bound by, I don't think another doctor somewhere else is bound by the laws in the state of Ohio, especially if that's not where they're domiciled, meaning where they live, where their license is registered, where they practice. And again, they've not advertised in Ohio, so they're not suggesting, at least under this hypothetical, say, hey, you know, come on over to Massachusetts and I can help you take care of your problems. If in fact it is the pregnant mother who sought out the health care in another jurisdiction in another state, for which that doctor has no connectivity to Ohio, Ohio does not have the national reach, if you will, to essentially reach over into another state and demand that that doctor or that practitioner appear in its court and, you know, stand before the court for and to respond to charges where Ohio law has no intersection with them. At least that would be my view. And I think that also at the same time, you'd have a state of Massachusetts that says, you know, we don't care if Ohio is demanding extradition or wants us to send this doctor to your state to face these criminal charges. We're not honoring that because that's not the law in our state. And every state has the right of sovereignty. And we will exercise that right of sovereignty to the benefit of our citizens.
But if Ohio had a warrant out for the doctor in Ohio, that would limit the doctor's ability to travel, correct?
It would at least limit their ability. It might limit their ability to travel elsewhere. So, I mean, even if they went to Texas, if Ohio issues a warrant, then Texas could arrest them and then extradite them Ohio. And so it could make it very difficult. But again, I think, you know, what needs to be, you know, certainly enforced or certainly recognized is the fact that even with an outstanding warrant, yes, that could make the doctor's life a little spurious and challenging. However, it is not without, it's not as if they don't have a legal argument to respond to the validity of the warrant and also to fight extradition, notwithstanding, because remember, if you're in another jurisdiction, even with a warrant, there is a requirement that you have a hearing prior to extradition. And right. I think there should be a very prepared defense to fight extradition under those circumstances because of the limited reach of the state of Ohio. It does not have the authority to essentially pluck people from anywhere in the country, even though it has the ability to issue warrants. You can't just pluck people from anywhere in the country because what you claim is essentially the laws of your state supersede that of anyone else's. Well, I suppose every state can make that argument and we would be in constant flux, but we should also understand that the current state of flux is all thanks to Chief Justice John Roberts.
And the Supreme Court. I agree wholeheartedly. All right, last question with hypothetical number one, and you touched on this just briefly. As a prosecutor, how would you go about proving the site of impregnation?
I think that's extremely difficult to determine, unless there is some high level of cooperation from... Actually, I wouldn't even say high level cooperation from, there's no victim here because the victim is actually the defendant. And the defendant has no obligation to cooperate with the prosecution.
And the preborn child that is, according to their definition, the preborn person that has been aborted certainly couldn't testify.
No, they could not. I mean, it's, and you also don't have any way of determining, you know, who the other biological parent is. How do you know who that is?
Well, especially you could maybe do that by DNA, but you couldn't pinpoint the time and place of impregnation.
But remember, the only way you get DNA is that you need samples. And so what are you going to ask for a court order for a DNA sample from the mother, from the defendant? Is the defendant now required to give a DNA sample? I could see all kinds of motions to quash and to suppress and to and request to deny the state's request for a DNA sample. Absolutely. The defense has no obligation to assist the prosecution in this case. If you are that assured that, you know, this preborn was actually created, that this the egg was fertilized in Ohio, then hopefully you have a plan to prove it without my help, because I'm not helping you.
Okay.
What would you do as a defense attorney? How would you respond? I'm just wondering. I mean, if you have a client that gets a...
I would say that you cannot prove, you cannot prove exact time, place without the testimony of some corroborating testimony from the mother, who's not obligated to testify, given her Fifth Amendment rights not to testify against herself.
Yeah. And so, you know, without that, it becomes a very, very difficult case to prove on a lot of levels. And these are, by the way, we're talking threshold issues in matters. We haven't even gotten to, you know, some
we haven't dug down to the deep issues. My hypotheticals are the, as you said, the threshold issues.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let me give you hypothetical number two, and let's see how this comes out. What would happen if a man and a woman are Ohio residents, but she gets impregnated, for example, while on vacation in North Carolina? The pregnant woman then travels to Massachusetts and obtains a legal abortion, and she returns to Ohio. Could she still be charged with murder in Ohio because the preborn person would have been a resident of Ohio?
Well, I don't know that the preborn person would have been a resident in Ohio. When is residency established? Is residency established at the time of fertilization? Is residency established at the time of birth?
Well, personhood, according to the bill, is established at the time of fertilization.
But what if mom never intended, despite being an Ohio resident, never intended to return to Ohio because her support system was in North Carolina? If she was going to have the child, she wasn't going to go back. So I don't think Ohio, again, for as much as it may want to, I don't know that the state of Ohio can regulate eggs and ovaries outside the borders of the state of Ohio. And you also cannot look into the mind of the now defendant, the defendant mother, to determine whether or not that mother intended to return to Ohio to establish residency for the preborn. Quite frankly, the preborn's residency is established, I guess, if anywhere, is North Carolina.
Yeah, at the point, using the logic of the bill, it would be where the impregnation took place.
Indeed. It's where it took place. And even if mom returned to Ohio for a brief or elongated period of time, that does not have any bearing on when the egg was actually fertilized, which was not within the state of Ohio.
So as a defense attorney, I'd be arguing that the preborn person was never a resident of Ohio and therefore not subject to Ohio's homicide laws.
Precisely.
All right.
I'm not even a defense attorney by trade, but I'm telling you, I think I'd sit on your side of the room.
Well, good. I need all the help I can get most of the time. So.
No, not at all. I just think that here's what I think is I think that as far as, you know, creative and as the legislature is becoming, what they are doing is they're just sharpening the tools of the advocates on one side or another. Because remember, under almost every other circumstance, this mother would have been my victim.
Right.
If there had been, you know, some other crime committed, we would not have criminalized her behavior. We would have been trying to really catch the bad guys. And now we're kind of reframing who the bad guys are. And we're saying that up is down is up, right is wrong, left is right. And this is just completely, you know, the antithesis of what we'd ever done before. Under most other circumstances, if we were in a courtroom setting, more likely than not, you know, under many scenarios, this mother would have been the victim in a case that I would have been prosecuting, where we really would have been looking for the bad guys. Now they'd be sitting on your side of the room, and you're literally looking to craft and sharpen a defense with all the tools available to maybe even save the mom's life, depending upon what the charge is. Really? That's what we're doing? We're killing mothers for being pregnant?
That's what it sounds like. All right, we're halfway home. Hypothetical number three of my four hypotheticals. You ready?
I think so.
All right. If a husband or a sexual partner forced the mother to have an abortion under duress, could the man or the sexual partner be charged with homicide?
Well, given that the legislature seems to only be interested in controlling, you know, women and their reproductive functions, it seems silent as to any responsibility for men, which is
totally
something
we hadn't even
touched on, is, you know, how we impute essentially the whole of the responsibility to women who, in again, many instances are actually the victims, and all but completely inoculate men from any responsibility. I don't know that the language of the statute would impute any responsibility for charging against the actual individual responsible for the duress. All it does is...
It just says the duress is a defense.
Yes.
To the woman.
All it does is provide that tiny sliver of an escape hatch by way of being able to raise it as a defense for having been charged with something so serious. And remember, the world of defenses is vast. There are many, many defenses that are available. Are you suggesting that a mother who is involved in a car crash, no fault of her own, and that car crash results in, you know, either injury to the baby or maybe even injury to herself or, you know, a miscarriage, that she could still be charged? Because again, the limitations on what, you know, what miscarriages are going to be acceptable is also very, very slim and narrow.
Yeah, it says spontaneous miscarriages.
Spontaneous.
Exactly.
Yeah, so what is spontaneous?
Yeah.
And again, if she's involved in a crash, not her fault, and it results in a miscarriage, do you still charge her for that?
Or if she's involved in a crash that is her fault.
That is her fault. Yep. Is she, again, is it, you know, she's, you know, maybe she's throwing up all night. She's sleep deprived. She still has somewhere to go. And nonetheless, she ends up in a minor fender bender. Maybe it's not even a serious crash, but it's
She rear-ended somebody.
Yeah. And then she ultimately learns 2 days later, 3 days later, she's having a miscarriage. And all of a sudden, does she now panic because, oh my gosh, she's going to get charged criminally? It may not have been spontaneous, but it may have been the result of, yes, maybe she does get charged with the fender benders. Maybe she does get cited. So what is a minor traffic offense that would have, in many other instances, probably cost no more than a fine, court cost, and yes, maybe a payout from the insurance company, if that, now results in what, homicide charges?
Or negligent homicide, or manslaughter charges, or something, you know, shy of murder, but still a criminal charge.
But still a criminal charge where there's loss of life. Really? It just seems so. I'm just struggling to wrap my head around this, but I'm also terrified of the idea that this is, because, you know, someone had to say, you know what, that sounds like a great idea. Yeah, this is something we ought to do. Yeah, we should start working on the language of it now, because
and we don't care what the people said.
Yeah, we could care less what the voters
because you know they pass things that are evil.
Yeah, the voters don't know what's good for them. You know, at one point, you know, slavery was on the books. Yeah.
Cheesy.
Ooh-wee. And the idea that you would even make that comparison is also insulting.
Well, of course it is.
It is absolutely insulting that comparison would even be made. But even with that being said, it is the idea that other states with similar legislative compositions, supermajorities or the like, would perhaps seek to subvert the will of their voters using a similar tactic.
This is a pilot. Yeah.
With the idea that if Ohio is successful, at least with this legislative tactic, even if it is challenged, it would be challenged to a Ohio Supreme Court that has essentially a super conservative majority, a 6-1 super conservative majority. And so again, this is back to politicizing the bench. The idea is that this super conservative Supreme Court would uphold it. And if you don't like those apples and you then decide to appeal it to the United States Supreme Court, unlike the Ohio Supreme Court that has to take your case because it's appealed there, the United States Supreme Court does not have to grant you certiorari or a hearing. And so it is entirely possible that you could be either stuck with whatever the decision is from the supermajority Ohio Supreme Court, or if you are granted certiorari from the United States Supreme Court, then that works out fine too, because there is a clear conservative lean to the court that is likely to keep this decision intact. You see the end game?
You know that's plan A and plan B of the proponents behind this bill. Mm-hmm. You know, is let's get it into court. Preferably, let's get it into the Ohio Supreme Court with the 6-1 supermajority, or let's get it up to the Supremes in Washington. And, you know, they're going to look at what they did to Roe. They could very well follow us along here.
And I guess my only, because there are a lot of things that I kind of, you know, I'm very hopeful would happen under these circumstances. But I think that the floor, the first rung, if you will, is respecting and honoring the will of the voters, even if you don't agree.
Yeah.
Because understand that for this legislator to talk about, you know, the status of slavery, understand that we as a nation never voted to enshrine slavery as a way of this country moving forward. We had to actually vote to abolish it. It wasn't that we all came together and said, yep, you know what, we're going to put this on the ballot. We're going to vote. Everybody want a slave? Yeah. No, it is because it became the way of life when human beings were being brought over and being just so demoralized and mistreated. And I'm putting that nicely when referring to how slaves were treated, but it actually took an act of legislative movement, and it took the Emancipation Proclamation to actually undo what had been done by natural tendency, not what had been established by law. Yes, once slavery was established, yes, states did begin to enact actual laws around it, but it wasn't like there was this original intent to, you know, oh, yeah, you know what we're going to do is we're going to build this country on slavery. No, you started bringing people over. You realized that free labor was actually good labor and you could actually make money off of it. And then as communities, colonies, states became established, then that's when you began to kind of enshrine that as part of, yeah, this is going to be kind of the legal makeup of this environment. And we had to undo that. This is not the same thing.
No.
This is
This is not the same thing.
This is literally, and I hold out hope that whether there is a 6-1 supermajority on the Ohio Supreme Court or whether there is a conservative slant on the United States Supreme Court, that at the end of the day, we need democracy to still hold strong and to hold together. And what we have told our citizenry is that this is their government and that democracies only work when people buy into the idea that their voices actually matter and that their votes actually count and that change can be made at the ballot box. And if what we are saying to them is, sucker, we got you to believe that again, only so that we can come back and change that, then we will not have a democracy much longer.
Because we know best.
Because we know better than you do. And so at the end of the day, what I am actually hopeful is that notwithstanding whatever their personal beliefs are or faith-based beliefs are or whatever your belief system is, and I'm not knocking it. I'm a PK. So I am not knocking your faith-based belief system. What I am saying is what your faith-based system is none of my damn business. And I am not here to proselytize. I am not here to impose that view on anyone. I am here to respect the right of the majority to govern. And that is what we have done successfully under this democracy. And if we're not going to do that, then damn it, we need to stop calling this a democracy. We need to call it whatever it's going to be, but a democracy is not it. And so hopefully you have justices that say, notwithstanding my personal faith-based beliefs, the voters have spoken. And they did so intentionally because we told them that if they voted, we would enshrine this in our state's constitution. It would become the law of this land and this state and this sovereign state, and that would settle the issue. We did not do that just to pull the rug from under them,
right,
and to trick them and to say, na 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 na, we got you to expend all this money, yeah, all this effort, go door knocking and get all of these votes out just so that we could undercut and undermine you because we wanted this way. You cannot call that a democracy. There are a lot of times when votes come down, ask anybody who's paying property taxes in a certain jurisdiction and they don't even have kids that go to the schools. They're right. Like, look, I don't like to pay more property taxes.
You still are.
And I vote them down every time. But guess what? There are more people here who vote for them that don't. So I still have to pay for them because I respect the right of the majority to govern. And I'm not going to go against that simply because I don't have one kid in the local school system. That's not what happens.
Let me jump in here because we only have about 4 minutes left. And I want to get to the last hypothetical because it's a totally different thing that I need your perspective on. It's presumed under this bill, House Bill 370, that the unborn fertilized egg, you know, has rights civilly as well as criminal protections. The current version says the intent is protecting the lives of preborn with the same civil and criminal laws protecting their lives of born persons. So same rights you have as a born person, you have as a pre-born person. Now, what if an aborted egg, embryo, fetus, that's considered a person, then does that aborted person have a right to have an estate in Ohio? And would the estate of the aborted egg, embryo, or fetus have legal standing to sue a hospital, doctor, or prospective mother civilly for money damages for wrongful death or civil rights violations?
Isn't that crazy? That very idea that we're even contemplating that. I'm just like, I'm trying to think of the case caption.
It would be the estate of preborn John Doe versus mother or hospital or doctor.
And to wit, I think my response would be, are we really doing this?
But I think under the statute, that's permitted. And it goes even further. Let me just, for the sake of time, try to shortcut this. If damages were obtained by the estate of preborn John Doe, who would get that money?
I was just going to say, and then to whose benefit?
Well, because preborn person John Doe doesn't have a last will and testament.
So they're intestate.
They're intestate without a will.
Before they ever even are born.
The estate would have to be distributed by Ohio statute of descent and distribution, which is how money is doled out if a person doesn't have a will.
Correct.
Well, the money couldn't go to the parents of the deceased, at least the mother, because she's charged with murder or homicide for causing the death. So they couldn't inherit the money. In that case, the money, according to the statute, Judge Gale, would go to the unborn or the preborn person, John Doe's siblings, if any.
How about the father?
If they were not, if they were not the siblings, if there were no siblings, it would go to the grandparents. The father, unless he was involved in the homicide. If he was involved in the homicide by giving advice or encouragement, then it couldn't go to him.
Well, here's another twist. What if the father of the preborn is actually the father of the defendant mother? Because this is the result of incest.
Uh-huh.
So this is how we provide a windfall?
You can see how confusing all of this is.
I'm not confused. I think that's deplorable. So basically, we reward you for impregnating your daughter?
Yeah. That would be possible under the statute.
Jesus.
Under the House Bill 370 in Ohio. And, you know, we usually don't try to concentrate on one state, but this is a model, folks, of what other states will be doing if Ohio is successful.
Or will attempt to do. Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, it might not make it the first time through, but, you know, how long did it take for Roe versus Wade to get overturned?
50 years. Give it time.
Yeah. So there's going to be iterations of this, even though this might be the first volley. We're not finished with this, even if this goes down in flames.
Mm-hmm. You will see some form of this again, I think, unless or until, and I don't know if this will happen in my lifetime, but unless or until we see a change in the U.S. Supreme Court that restores Roe, or we see a legislative shift or a change in the federal legislature that enshrines Roe.
Or a federal constitutional amendment.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That would enshrine Roe.
Yep.
Well, we're out of time, Judge Gale. And as always, at the end of this, my head hurts. we had to do some mental and legal gymnastics, but I think it was important for our listeners to see how complex this whole situation is and how many loopholes there are and how many unanswered questions there are. Just for the sake of zealotry.
Which I think we agree that legislation is often crafted without the benefit of forward thinkingness, right?
But yeah,
that something
absolutely.
Like this, again, being motivated, I think, by something other than the will of the people or what is in the people's best interest and being sold as some kind of comparison to the atrocities of slavery when, you know, we, you know, when we were a much younger nation, is again, it is just a slight. It is the height of hypocrisy. There are no rules in place for the men who engage in this behavior. And it feels like it's an assault on the equality of women in so many ways that this is, you're right.
It's an assault on women, period.
It is. It really is.
It's an assault on women, period.
And to have you as a co-host to actually recognize that for what it is certainly speaks volumes. And I'm so grateful because it just seems so obvious to me. But to our listeners, again, we usually don't necessarily just highlight what's happening in one state, but because we have seen this play out of this playbook before, where you have a template that is set up, and then you have the efforts to run the play, and even if the play isn't successful, you don't take the play out of the playbook. You just tweak it a little bit, and you keep running it until it is actually successful, and then you provide that as a blueprint to others so that they can then duplicate it, I think becomes that recipe for the downfall of an entire country. And what I think we see is we certainly have, as you said, we have people who are zealots and they hope and cling deeply to their faith-based beliefs. But that, again, I don't think that there was any or should be any suggestion that I am required to adopt your faith-based belief or that you're required to adopt mine. If I live my life in a way that you think that, you know, whatever faith I practice is a good enough faith that is something you'd like to invest your time in, then I am doing what I'm supposed to be doing and honoring my faith. But me imposing that on you in such a heavy-handed and undermining kind of way is not, I don't think that that is any way to express or to live your faith. That is how you live hypocrisy.
How do people find us, Judge Gale, if they want to hear more of our rantings about all kinds of issues with the law?
Well, we will invite you to check us out because you can see we have a good time having these exchanges and hopefully educating you in the process. But you can check us out anywhere you find your favorite podcasts. We can be found, of course, on our primary sponsor, NPR. We are so grateful to National Public Radio and for all of the hard work that National Public Radio does to improve the lives of listeners all over the world. But you can also find us on Apple, Spotify, or Amazon, or again, anywhere else you find your favorite podcast. Just check us out. We are Next Witness, Please.
And if you have questions or comments about our podcast, you can always shoot me an email. My email address is Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. That's Hodson at ohio.edu. And also, if you have topics that you'd like for us to cover in the future, I just received an email this week of something that we might consider talking about in the future. So shoot that email off to me and we'll put your topic on our list. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media, part of Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.